Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We have a really fascinating stack of research on the desk today, and it all centers around a PhD thesis by Wilberth Solano Alvarez. And look, I know what you're probably thinking. Usually when we start talking about, you know, infrastructure or industrial components, people's eyes glaze over.
Right. It doesn't exactly scream thriller or mystery novel, does it?
Exactly. But today is different. We are going to be talking about something that is probably spinning within, what, 10 feet of you right now.
Oh, easily.
It might even be inside the device you are using to listen to this. It's in the cooling fan of your laptop. It's in the wheels of your car. It's in your blender. And on a much, much grander scale, it is the beating heart of those massive wind turbines out in the ocean.
We are talking about the rolling bearing.
The rolling bearing.
The absolute workhorse of the modern world. I mean, it is the unsung hero that allows everything to move. If bearings stop rolling, civilization basically grinds to a halt.
And that is exactly the problem we are digging into today. Because despite, you know, 100 years of engineering, despite being built to take absolute punishment, these things fail.
And they don't just wear out gracefully.
No, they fail in a way that has been, frankly, baffling engineers for decades.
It really is a forensic mystery.
Yeah.
We aren't talking about a part just getting old. We are looking at a specific type of microstructural decay, a sort of metal plague, really, that eats these bearings from the inside out.
And the stakes here aren't just, oh no, my blender broke. We are talking about offshore wind farms where replacing a single gearbox can cost millions of dollars.
Millions. In cranes, ships, downtime, all of it.
So the mission for this deep dive is simple. We are going to shrink ourselves down to the nanometer scale to solve a chicken or the egg mystery involving a defect with a very strange name.
White etching matter, or WEM.
It sounds like something from a ghost story.
It has certainly haunted the metallurgy industry long enough. It's a massive headache.
So let's jump in. Before we get to the crime scene, we need to know the victim. I mean, what are these bearings actually made of? I assume it's not just generic iron.
No, absolutely not. We are talking about a material that is legendary in the engineering world. It's the industry standard, known as AII 52100 steel.
521 Laruo. Is that just a serial number, or does that tell us something?
Oh, it tells us exactly what's in the pot. This is a high-carbon chromium steel. You are looking at about 1% carbon and 1.5% chromium. And the reason it is the standard is because of one thing. It's hardness.
Okay, let's unpack hard. Because diamonds are hard, but you wouldn't make a wheel out of a diamond.
That's a great distinction. In engineering, hardness is specifically resistance to, well, indentation. You press something into it, does it leave a dent? On the Rockwell C scale, 52100 steel sits between 59 and 66 HRC.
Numbers are great, but give us a visual. What does 66 HRC feel like?
To put that in perspective for you, this steel can handle rolling contact stresses of around 2 gigapascals.
2 gigapascals.
So imagine balancing a large SUV on the tip of a ballpoint pen. That is the kind of pressure these bearings take. And they do it millions of times.
Wow. Okay, that puts it in perspective. So how do they get it that strong? Is it just the recipe or is it the cooking?
It is definitely the cooking. It's all about the heat treatment. They heat the steel up, that's a process called austenitizing, and then they quench it. They plunge it into oil to cool it incredibly fast.
Right.
That violence, that thermal shock, creates a specific microstructure called martensite.
Martensite? I've seen photos of this. It doesn't look like a solid block. It looks chaotic.
It does. Under a microscope, martensite looks like a pile of needles or plates all mashed together.
Yeah.
And that internal stress is actually what makes it so hard. It is like a coiled spring that is locked in place.
But here is where the plot thickens. Every hero has a fatal flaw, right? Superman has kryptonite. What is the flaw of 52100 steel?
Its flaw is brittleness, because it is so rigid, it hates to bend. So when those needles of martensite are forming and clashing against each other, the steel is susceptible to microscopic cracking.
So it's incredibly strong against pressure, the SUV on the pen tip, but if you twist it the wrong way, it might crack.
Precisely. And that microscopic vulnerability brings us right to the antagonist of our story.
The white etching matter.
The WEM.
Right. Let's break this down, because when I read that, I imagine something bleaching the steel. What are we actually looking at?
So imagine you cut a slice of a failed bearing, you polish it, and then you etch it with a chemical, usually needle. Normal, healthy steel will react and turn a dark gray color.
Okay, that's the healthy stuff.
But these specific damaged regions, they refuse to react. Under the microscope, they shine stark white against that dark background. Hence, white etching matter.
It's like a scar that won't tan.
That is a great way to put it.
Yeah.
But it is not just a color change. The structure has completely transformed. It is no longer those needle-like plates. It has turned into a swarm of nanoscaled ferrite grains. And here's the kicker. This white stuff is significantly harder than the original steel.
Wait. Usually decay means something gets soft. You were saying the decayed part is harder?
30 to 50% harder. And because it's harder, it's even more brittle. And it forms these very distinctive shapes, sometimes layers, sometimes spheres. But the most famous one is the butterfly.
The butterfly. Sounds surprisingly poetic for heavy industry.
It looks beautiful in a destructive way. You'll see a central crack, or maybe a tiny impurity, and extending out from it are these wings of white matter.
So you have this butterfly of hard, brittle material growing inside the steel. Why is there a debate? I mean, that sounds like the cause right there.
That is exactly what Campe thinks.
Campe?
Yeah, the industry has been split for years. Campe believes that WHIM is the disease. They think some chemical change happens first, generates this hard white matter, and because that brittle stuff is there, the bearing cracks.
Okay, so WHIM is the cause. It's the virus that kills the host.
Right, but Campe says, no, you have got it backward. They believe a tiny crack forms first from fatigue or an impurity, and the white etching matter is just a symptom, a byproduct.
This is the classic chicken or the egg. Why does it matter so much which one came first?
Oh, it matters immensely. It changes everything about how you fix it. If you run a wind farm and you think WHIM is the cause, you might try to change the lubricant right. Add some chemical additives.
But if Camp B is right and the crack comes first,
then all those fancy oil additives are useless. You are treating a broken bone with a Band-Aid. You need to stop the physical cracking. You need a tougher steel.
I see. So this PhD thesis by Solano Alvarez was about settling a very, very expensive bet for the global energy industry.
Exactly. And to settle it, he had to get creative.
So what did he do?
He decided that to understand how the bearing dies, he had to act as the killer. He performed what he called controlled cracking experiments.
He broke them on purpose.
He damaged them very specifically. The logic was, if I put a specific crack into the steel before I even start the test, I can watch how that crack interacts with the material. If Camp B is right, that crack should generate a ton of WHIM.
That makes perfect sense. But how do you crack a bearing gently? You can't just hit it with a hammer.
No. It is precise metallurgy. He used a few methods. One was manipulating the heat treatment. But the most extreme method, and my personal favorite, involved cryogenics.
Freezing it?
Dipping the steel into liquid nitrogen. It makes the steel incredibly hard, but also incredibly sensitive.
Like putting it in glass cannon mode.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Once it was that brittle, he could induce tiny specific surface cracks just by pressing a diamond tip into the surface.
So now he has his victim prepped with these specific cracks. Then what?
Then he puts them through the torture chamber. A rolling contact fatigue test. It's a machine that basically simulates the life of a bearing in fast forward. Millions of cycles of a heavy load rolling over that crack.
And this is the moment of truth. What happened? Did the pre-cracked samples get the butterfly?
They didn't just get it, they were infested with it. The answer was definitive. The samples with pre-existing cracks showed a significantly higher amount of hard white etching matter.
So Camp B wins. The crack causes the white matter.
Camp B wins. But Solano Alvarez went further. He didn't just say, the crack did it. He explained how. And this is where it gets really interesting. It wasn't a chemical reaction, it was friction.
Friction inside the metal.
Think about those two faces of the microscopic crack. They're pressed together under immense pressure, and as the roller passes over, they rub against each other.
Like rubbing two sticks together to start a fire?
Exactly like that, but on a nanoscale. That rubbing creates intense localized heat and intense plastic deformation. It literally mashes the steel structure.
Mashes it.
It grinds it up. The friction is so intense that the carbides in the steel dissolve, the grains get pulverized down to nanometers, and what you're left with is this super hard, white etching scar tissue.
That is a powerful image. So the butterfly isn't a parasite eating the steel, it is a callus.
A callus is the perfect analogy. The WHIM is the consequence of the surfaces grinding their teeth together.
So those butterfly wings we talked about.
Those wings are just the visual path of the stress. You have a void or an impurity, that's the body of the butterfly. The crack starts there. The rubbing happens, and that altered, mashed up material grows outwards.
Mystery one solved. The crack is the culprit. But looking at the notes, there's another twist in this. A second villain.
Yes.
Hydrogen. We hear about hydrogen embrittlement all the time. It's usually the boogeyman in steel.
It is. Hydrogen is the smallest element, so it can slip between the iron atoms and weaken the bonds holding the metal together. Usually you add hydrogen to a stressed part, it snaps immediately.
Right, so the assumption here would be you take these pre-cracked samples, add hydrogen, and it should be a total catastrophe.
That was the hypothesis. Cracks plus hydrogen should equal an explosion of whim.
And?
Nothing happened.
Nothing.
The pre-crack samples did not show the accelerated damage from hydrogen that everyone expected. It was completely counterintuitive.
Did the hydrogen not get in?
Oh, it got in. But the cracks played a double agent.
How so?
It turns out the cracks acted as traps. Imagine the hydrogen atoms wandering through the steel. When they encounter the massive distortion of a crack, they get stuck. They bind to the surface.
So the crack effectively jails the hydrogen.
Yes. The thesis calls it being held in a molecular and innocuous form. By trapping the hydrogen, the cracks prevented it from getting further into the lattice to weaken the bonds.
That is wild. The physical defect, the crack, actually inoculated the steel against the chemical defect.
It is a paradox. The thing that was killing the bearing was also protecting it from the other killer. It challenges the long-held assumption that cracks always accelerate hydrogen damage.
Okay, so we have learned two massive things. One, white etching matter is caused by rubbing cracks. Two, cracks can actually trap hydrogen, but we're still left with the problem. The bearings are still cracking.
Right, we know why they fail, but they are still failing. 52100 steel, for all its hardness, is still too brittle.
So where do we go from here? Did the thesis offer a solution or just a diagnosis?
It offered a glimpse of the future. He pivoted his research to test an alternative material, something called nanostructured bainite.
Nanobainite? Sounds expensive.
It sounds sci-fi, but it is actually a very clever arrangement of steel. It's an extremely fine mixture of ferrite and austenite. But the key difference compared to 152100 is what it doesn't have.
Which is?
Carbides. 152100 steel is full of carbides, hard chunks of carbon and iron. Nanobainite is carbide-free.
Why does that matter for our butterfly problem?
Well, remember how the white etching matter forms. It is supersaturated with carbon. In the old steel, that carbon comes from the carbides dissolving during that intense friction.
So if you remove the carbides...
You remove the fuel. You starve the butterfly.
That makes sense chemically. But is it tough?
That is the best part. It behaves completely differently under fatigue. Instead of that brittle, catastrophic cracking we see in martensite, nanobainite fails through something called ductile void formation.
Ductile void formation. Translate that.
Think of Swiss cheese forming slowly versus a window shattering. In nanobainite, tiny holes form and slowly join together. It is a much more gradual, predictable failure. It doesn't just explode.
And the million-dollar question. When they ran the torture test on the nanobainite, did they find any white etching matter?
Zero.
None?
No hard white etching matter was found. Because there were no carbides to dissolve and the material was tougher, the mechanism just couldn't start.
That feels like a mic drop moment for metallurgy.
It really is. It suggests that if we want to stop this white etching plague, we need to stop obsessing over making steel harder and start thinking about making it tougher and carbide free.
So let's bring this all back to reality for the listener. What does this actually mean for the world?
It means we have been chasing ghosts. For a long time, the industry was trying to figure out what chemical gremlin was creating this white matter. Solano Alvarez showed us, stop chasing the white matter, chase the crack.
Treat the disease, not the symptom.
Exactly. If we shift our focus from pure hardness to toughness, resistance to fracture, we can build bearings that actually last their intended lifespan.
And that connects directly to the green energy revolution.
It is a direct line. It sounds abstract, but better bearing steels mean wind turbines that don't need their gearboxes replaced every 5 years. That drives down the maintenance cost, which drives down the cost per kilowatt hour of wind energy.
So the economic viability of sustainable energy is partly written in the microstructure of steel.
Absolutely. We can build all the turbines we want, but if the steel gives up, the economics don't work. Material science is the bedrock all these grand ideas rest on.
It is amazing how it all connects. We started with a microscopic white smudge on a piece of metal and ended up at the future of the global energy grid.
That is the beauty of this field. You pull on a loose thread at the nanoscale and you find it is attached to the entire economy.
So here's the thought I want to leave you with. Next time you see a wind turbine spinning, or even just hear your laptop fan whirring, think about the battle happening inside those bearings.
Think about the friction.
Think about the friction, and think about the butterfly. In nature, a butterfly is a sign of life. But in the world of steel, as we have learned today, a butterfly is a scar. It is the mark of a material screaming under pressure.
But knowing how that scar forms, understanding that it comes from the crack and not the other way around, is the only way we can build a world that keeps on rolling.
And that is where we will leave it for this deep dive. Thanks for listening, and keep wondering about the stuff things are made of.
See you next time.